invite you to stand and join in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible.
Will the clerk call the roll, please?
Mr. McDavid?
Here.
Mr. Ruffin?
Here.
Mr. Trapp?
Here.
Mr. Scala?
Here.
Mr. Thomas?
Here.
Ms. Nauzer? Ms. Peters?
Here.
We have minutes from the regular council meeting of December 21st, 2015. Are there any corrections to the minutes? If not, may I have a motion and second to approve?
So moved. Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Are there any corrections to the agenda?
Mayor, I'd like to request removal of B37615 and B37715 from the consent agenda, please.
Any other corrections?
I'm sorry, which ones were?
376 and 377. And
you were going to ask for 377.
Yeah. I was?
I had an email that said you were, maybe.
Okay. Maybe I'm trying to make sure I've got the right one. You guys are faster than I am today.
They will be under old business.
Okay. Thank you.
May I have a motion second to approve the agenda as amended?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Welcome. During the meeting, we offer several opportunities for comment, public comment. Each individual is entitled to 3 minutes, and I'll ask you to respect the timer that's in front of the dais. If you're a representative of the representative of an organization that is primarily and directly involved in the issue at hand, you may ask for and will be granted 5 minutes.
Thank you very much.
I'll ask Mr. Stephen Sapp, Mr. St. Romain, and Ms. Amin to meet at the podium.
Good evening. It's my pleasure to introduce Steve Sapp as the latest addition to our management team as Community Relations Director. As you know, we went through an exhaustive search trying to find just the right person for the job, and we found him here at the City of Columbia already. He's worked for, I think, around 36 years, has had many, many roles, starting with work in PSJC department, as Battalion Chief for the Fire Department, and his most recent role as a public information officer for the Public Works Department. So Steve has a great background in the city, and we look forward to working with him in the future. And so, Steve, welcome, and I'll have Sheila swear you in.
I, Stephen Sapp,
Do solemnly swear that I possess all qualifications for the office of
Director of Community Relations
for the City of Columbia,
Missouri,
that I am not subject
to any of the disqualifications
set forth in the Charter
of the City of Columbia,
that I will support the Constitution
and laws of the United States
and of the State of Missouri
and the Charter and ordinances
of the City of Columbia,
and that I will faithfully discharge
the duties of my office.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
seems odd to welcome you to the staff since you've been here for 36 years, but I'll do so anyway. Those who have contacted the city manager's office by noon on Wednesday prior to the council meeting can speak on the same topic. Tonight we have two requests. I will point out that the council does not address or debate these issues that are brought up under scheduled comments at the time the comments are made, but we very likely may discuss these issues at the end of the meeting during open council comment time. I'll yield 5 minutes to Annette Triplett.
Hello, council members. My name is Annette Triplett. I'm executive director of PedNet Coalition 201 West Broadway. PedNet is an advocacy organization for the most basic forms of transportation: walking, biking, using a wheelchair, and public transit. Policies that make it safer and more convenient for people to use active forms of transportation often make transportation safer as well for people who choose to drive a car. One such policy that I'd like to introduce you to is called Vision Zero. Vision Zero is a policy goal and data-driven strategy to achieve zero traffic fatalities or serious injuries across all forms of transportation. Vision Zero is based strongly on ethical principles and the foundation that all traffic fatalities and injuries are both preventable and ethically unacceptable. While we may never completely eliminate traffic crashes, we can prevent crashes from leading to serious injuries or death. Vision Zero challenges the culture of acceptance associated with motor vehicle travel, that traffic fatalities and injuries are inevitable and just the cost of doing business. This is in stark contrast to other transportation modes, such as air travel, where zero fatalities are tolerated. Vision Zero places responsibility for safety on system design and the people who influence the design of policies, which I think includes all of us, and causes us to think about how we can account for human error. Every crash with serious injuries or fatalities is an opportunity to look at the road system and think, what was wrong here? What should I have done to prevent this? Vision Zero is also comprehensive in that it considers all road users and values the safety of people walking, biking, or using a wheelchair just as much as people driving. Because Vision Zero is data-driven, it forces us to take a hard look at why our crashes are happening and what type of transportation users are involved in our crashes, including vulnerable road users, like people walking and biking, who, by definition, are most likely to be killed or injured if there is a crash. For example, in Colombia, people walking or biking are involved in only 3% of our crashes, but account for 25% of our fatalities. This is why we at PedNet are so interested in Vision Zero, because we see this type of policy as a way to make transportation safer for people walking and biking. But frankly, most of the people who stand to benefit from a Vision Zero policy are people who travel by car, because they make up the majority of the fatalities and injuries and crashes. So Vision Zero is a win-win for all forms of transportation. Implementing Vision Zero doesn't have to mean overhauling every intersection or spending massive amounts of money. Vision Zero relies on proven strategies that can be no cost or low cost, like reducing speed limits, offering safety education through ticket diversion programs for traffic offenders, and increasing fines for unsafe transportation behaviors. Major cities across the U.S. have recently passed Vision Zero policies, including Boston, New York City, Washington, D.C., Portland, Seattle, and San Francisco. These cities are adopting Vision Zero policies because Vision Zero is producing good results and saving lives. In the first year that New York City implemented their Vision Zero policy, they saw their lowest pedestrian fatality rate since record keeping began in 1910. Some of the longest term data on Vision Zero has come out of Sweden, where they've seen a 73% reduction in fatalities since they began implementing their policy in the 1990s. You're going to hear an interim report tonight from the Mayor's Task Force on Pedestrian Safety. The task force has voted to use Vision Zero as the basis of their upcoming pedestrian safety recommendations to council. PedNet Coalition feels strongly that Vision Zero is the next step that the community needs to take to improve transportation safety in Colombia, and we look forward to exploring this policy with you in the near future. Thank you.
I'll yield 5 minutes to Lynn Maloney.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Council for your responsiveness to race matters concerns in the last half of 2015 and look forward to your continued support in making racial justice a priority in Colombia in the new year. As racial disparities continue to increase, it is important that we all become willing to discuss race explicitly as we strive for racial and social equity. I'd also like to thank Councilman Scala for his comment at the end of last council's meeting, in which he referenced the many excellent resources for discussing race, which he forwarded to all of you. I'd like to focus in particular on one of those documents titled The Application of the Racial Equity Toolkit in City Government. Published by the Government Alliance on Racial Equity, you can find many examples on GARE's website of reports that include examples of how several cities have already implemented these tools for racial equity, as well as definitions of a variety of terms like systemic and structural racism that can enhance our ability to discuss, understand, and work for racial justice with greater clarity. The Racial Equity Toolkit is based on asking six questions during the creation of proposals for the city. These are questions that should be asked during the implementation of the recommendations for the Mayor's Task Force on Community Violence. Those recommendations are written primarily in race-neutral language, but should be implemented with racial equity in mind. The six questions are, first, what is the proposal and its desired outcome? This question is meant to be answered using data disaggregated by race. The second question, what does the data tell us? The third, how have the affected communities been engaged and how can we expand their engagement? Fourth, who will benefit? And if those benefiting are not racially diverse, what strategies do we have for creating racial equity? Fifth, what is the implementation plan for those strategies? And sixth, what accountability and commitment does a proposal have in place for meeting racial equity? The report goes on to say that while most government agencies will argue that they do not have time to answer all of these questions, there are at least three questions which really should be included in every product and project. One is, what are the racial equity impacts of the particular decision? Who will benefit? And are there strategies to mitigate unintended consequences? Those of us who identify as white must overcome our reluctance to discuss race. We are more comfortable talking about economic disparities. However, the growing divergences in economic equity are growing along racial lines. Understanding the variety of factors that contribute to these disparities beyond the economic is essential to creating equity. The Racial Equity Toolkit is a method for exposing the many causes for disparities that are so often invisible to us as we make plans to improve our city. It is time to hold ourselves accountable for racial equity. The Racial Equity Toolkit is a resource that can help all of us do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Please read PH1-16.
PH1-16 is the construction of the Rollins at Rock Creek Culvert Replacement Project.
Staff, please.
This public hearing is for the replacement of a stormwater culvert under Rollins Road near Rock Creek Drive. This project will replace an existing 6-foot metal culvert with a larger precast concrete culvert. The connecting inlets and junction box will also be replaced with this project. This project is expected to take about 3 to 4 weeks in length, and Rollins Road in this area will be closed during the construction of this project. The estimated cost of this project is estimated to be $400,000 and will be paid for with stormwater utility funds. An interested parties meeting for this project was held on November 11th of 2015, and three people were in attendance, and they all expressed support for this project to move forward. This culvert is located in a regulated floodplain. This project will be designed to convey a 1% storm in accordance with floodplain regulations and will be required to obtain a floodplain permit as part of this project. This culvert is being recommended for replacement at this time due to its condition, its history, and its impending failure for this project and the resulting impact on the road it would have. The potential for upstream homes to flood should be reduced with the completion of this project. And at this time, just to answer any questions you have about this public hearing for this project.
Any questions by council? Hearing none, I'll open the public hearing. Would anyone like to speak?
Mayor McDavid, members of the council, Thank you for an opportunity to be here to speak to you this evening. I'm here talking on behalf of the kids. My name is Glenn Chambers. I live at 807 Cornell in the vicinity of where this construction will take place. My wife Jeannie and I own that property. We've lived there for 35 years. We applaud the city for their stance in correcting the failing culvert under Rollins Road. I have one observation and question. The three speed bumps that have been installed on College Park have been extremely effective in reducing the speed of the traffic down through there. My question is, would it be possible to include a similar speed bump on Rollins Road during the repairing of the street in the construction zone during its completion? That's an option that we have for keeping our kids safe. I think if any of you have traveled from Stadium to Russell Boulevard School, you understand what the situation can be. Gravity is in force, and a lot of those people that come through there are going in excess of 50 miles an hour. They have been clocked that way by the City of Columbia Police. I would respectfully ask that you consider a speed bump in the middle of the Rollins Road. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Michelle Woodmiller, 705 East Rock Creek Drive. In the report that you received at some point, you talked about there's a mention of a house that had a devastating flood because of the failure of this culvert in 2010. And I just wanted to show my support for this project. If it can happen tomorrow, that'd be great. And while I definitely agree with Mr. Chambers that the speed is too much on Rollins, if it would slow down this project, I would prefer that not happen and that the project happen as soon as possible so that we don't have any catastrophic failures. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? In that case, I'll close the public hearing. We'll go to council discussion. I guess I view the speed bump as traffic calming that needs to be seriously considered. I don't really consider it part of this project, but I do think staff should put this on the list of constituent concerns, and we certainly need to evaluate that independently.
We'll make sure that request gets turned over to the street and have them make a recommendation back to you.
Yeah.
Right. Great. But I certainly plan to support this project.
What is the time frame for getting this culvert in?
Well, this is just the public necessity, so we still have to go through the design phase. But I know in talking to the engineers, they are moving as fast as we can with this project. Matter of fact, one of the things they emphasize, if there's anything that anybody wants to change, we just don't want it to impact the time frame on this. Because like the citizen said, we have had some failures on the inlet side of this that we would rather not have again. So I would imagine we will try to be hitting the spring construction season.
Did anything acutely happen with the last heavy rainfall that we had here?
As far as I know, no, but they had to go through and do some kind of on-site repairs that are temporary, and they know they won't last long, so we need to get this done.
Any other discussion?
I'll just say I think it's a very much-needed project, and it does underscore the struggle that the stormwater utility has, where they really have to focus on immediate concerns where there could be a catastrophe. We have passed an increase in the stormwater fee, which will gradually phase in over the next few years, so hopefully they can get a little bit ahead of these catastrophic projects to be a little more proactive. I would also say I support Glenn's call for speed management on Rollins. There have been a series of very serious crashes a little east of this location, and I think it's a difficult street because there are parts of it that encourage quite fast speeds, and then there is that sharp curve or double curve just east of Russell Boulevard School, which has proved fatal for a number of drivers in recent years.
May I have a motion directing staff to proceed with plans and specifications for the Rollins at Rock Creek Culvert Replacement Project?
So moved.
Second.
Any more discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Please read PH 216 and B37915.
PH 2 is the construction of improvements to the Albert Oakland Family Aquatic Center to include replacement of the bathhouse roof and exterior lighting, installation of a cantilever shade structure on the southeast corner of the pool deck, and replacement of interior bathhouse plumbing fixtures and lighting. Council Bill 37915 is an ordinance determining it is in the public interest to construct improvements to the Albert Oakland Family Aquatic Center to include replacement of the bathhouse roof and exterior lighting, installation of a cantilever shade structure on the southeast corner of the pool deck, and replacing interior bathhouse plumbing fixtures and lighting, approving and adopting plans and specifications, determining that a portion of the work shall be done by contract, calling for bids through the purchasing division, determining that a portion of the work shall be done by city employees, providing for payment for the improvement, authorizing the city manager to obtain, execute, and record all documents necessary for the improvement, providing for compliance with the prevailing wage law and state mandated construction safety training, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff.
Thank you, Mayor. This project is improvements to the Albert Oakland Family Aquatic Center, specifically the bathhouse and exterior lighting. The project funding is $80,000, with it coming from the 2010 park sales tax, a major maintenance fund. This project located in Albert Oakland Park, which is a 73-acre park located at 1900 Blue Ridge Road, which is in Ward 2, but it's right on the edge of Ward 3 as well. The main project of this is replacing the roof, the metal roof. We estimate that at $45,000 for this portion. The other is replacing all of the lights. We have a variety of light fixtures out there. Over the years, we've added poles and interior lights and things like that. So we've got regular incandescent bulbs, fluorescent bulbs, sodium halide bulbs, and we're going to replace them all with LED bulbs. The exterior ones will be similar to the ones we have at Stevens Lake Park. The project also includes replacement of all the plumbing fixtures and valves inside the bathhouse. Some of these valves are the old twist handle. They met the ADA requirements earlier, but not the new ones that just recently passed, and so this will bring them all into compliance. These are the type of fixtures here shown in this photo that we've done at the MLK and MKT Stadium Trailside Building renovation. We estimate this at $12,000. The project also includes shade. That's an important part of our what our pool users want is more shade, and so we'll add a 20 by 60 cantilever shade structure on the southeast corner of the deck. We estimate that at $10,000. We're saving about $2,000 for a contingency. The Parks and Recreation Commission endorsed this project at their November 19th meeting. We'll start work this winter with the goal of having all the improvements done by the time we open up this spring. So following the public hearing, staff request council approve the ordinance authorizing the project to proceed. Thank you.
Any questions by council? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Seeing none, we'll move to council discussion.
Well, I, for one, certainly am in favor of this project. I think it's another example of Parks and Rec and a measure of their fiscal responsibility as it relates to maintenance. I think it's very important. Might I add that one of the reasons why Parks and Rec has the capacity to do this is there is a dedicated revenue stream that's endorsed by public referendum, and I appreciate the public for supporting that. These kinds of improvements and maintenance are vital to our ongoing excellent park system in this community.
Once again, this is about the last checkoff from the 2010 parks tax, and I think one of the reasons that Parks and Rec are held in high esteem in the community is that you make promises and keep them, and whenever you go back asking to continue revenue stream, you come back with a very detailed list of what you're going to do with the money, and you keep your promises. So congratulations on the status and respect that you've earned. Call the roll on 37915.
Council Bill 37915, Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
We'll go to old business, 35615.
Council Bill 356-15 is an ordinance levying a special assessment and authorizing the issuance of a special tax bill as it relates to the reconstruction of the sidewalk along the south side of Broadway from 8th Street to 9th Street in the city of Columbia, Missouri, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective.
Staff, please.
Yes, the Broadway sidewalk reconstruction project from 8th Street to 9th Street was completed in 2011, and public hearings were held December 5th, 2011, and January 3rd, 2012, concerning special assessments against properties benefited by and abutting the constructed sidewalk improvement. At the January 3rd, 2012 council meeting, council further discussed the issue concerning a property owner, Mr. Fagan's claim of moisture in his basement, and determined that since it was not known whether the moisture was an issue before or after the sidewalk was installed, that the legislation be amended to remove that portion of the tax bill associated with Mr. Fagan's property. The city attorney further suggested that if there was a dispute between Mr. Fagan and the city, it would be best to resolve through a claim with the city instead of other measures. All other property owners have paid their tax bill at this time. To date, staff has been unsuccessful in resolving this issue with Mr. Fagan and his attorney. Staff recommends moving forward with the legal's earlier recommendation to treat the tax bill issue separately from a claim, and recommend council pass the legislation to impose the tax bill on Mr. Fagan's property in the amount of $5,959.03. Mr. Fagan still has the option to pursue a claim with the city. Be happy to answer any questions.
Council?
I guess this is a question for legal, and you can choose not to answer this depending on your legal perspective. But what is the sticking point for the settlement? Is there a sticking point? Is without getting into the details of...
Right. I don't know the details of Mr. Fagan's claim, to be honest with you. Someone else in my staff has been handling that particular issue. I think what the concern is at this point is they have reached an impasse. And that those two issues are really separate issues as it relates to the actual sidewalk assessment versus what his particular claim is. And staff's recommendation is to separate out those issues.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Any other questions? Any other?
Yeah, I've got a more general question about the policy here. When sidewalks are repaired downtown, there's a 50-50 cost share between the city. Who initiates the project? If the city can decide that we want to improve a sidewalk and the abutting property owners have to pay 50% of that cost?
Yeah, we've had some in the past come forward with council on various properties. I know Mr. Girding's had a 50-50 cost share on a 6th Street, I believe. And so it's something the property owners bring forward to staff, and they work through the process for that 50-50 cost share.
Whereas sidewalk maintenance or repairs in other parts of the city are generally expected to be paid 100% by the property owners?
It depends on some of those locations. So, this has been a downtown policy for as long as I can remember. That 50-50 has been in place.
Yeah, there's certain areas of the city, especially some of the CDBG areas, where if we can get a CDBG grant to cover that, we basically paid 100%. But central city policy has always been a 50-50 split with the property owners, and they come to us and request that typically.
And but can we go to them and demand?
Oh, we could. In fact, we did that with Avenue of the Columns when we actually did that. We actually had some tax credits involved too, but then that was an issue of us going to them saying, you know, this is our plan for this particular street renovation project for the Avenue of the Columns.
Yep, I remember it.
We got the support from them, and they participated, and we shared 50-50 with them.
And does it also apply to installing sidewalks if there are places downtown where they don't exist, as well as maintenance or improvements?
That same policy could be used for that same situation.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Any other questions? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Would you like 5 minutes?
Yes, please. My name is Arnold Fagan. I reside at 810 East Broadway downtown in a building I own. In 2010, the city replaced the sidewalk on the south side of Broadway between 8th and 9th Street. And actually, that was one where I'd worked with a previous city manager, Bill Watkins, and got the property, the neighboring property owners, to agree to fix this sidewalk. It was in bad shape, as well as we wanted to install more sprinklers on the south side and make it easier. So after the street and sidewalk was torn up, the north side of my building adjacent to the construction work started flooding. I used to say I had the only dry basement in all of downtown Columbia, in all of Columbia probably. So for 11 years preceding that construction, I used to use the shelves on the north wall, on that exact wall, to store more than 100 boxes of paper files and records. That was my record storage. The documents were never damaged by water. As we had these leaks during the construction process, I addressed this to various members of the city staff and contractors. I've documented it. I've got, you know, ream of information about it. And I was personally assured by people, including Mr. Glasscock, that they wouldn't let their work damage my building. What happened was the city contractors cut corners in the project. There were two reasons they did this. One, they were part of the contract, as I understand it, was they were fined each day that they were late on the project as per the contract, so they had to hurry up. There was also the second reason that I was told was they were under political pressure to finish the sidewalk work before the Roots and Blues Festival, which was sponsored by a bank on the same block, before it started. So they were in hurry-up mode. In the areas the work was performed correctly, there were no leaks. But in the area the city didn't construct according to their own specifications, I'm not an engineer, but I'm going by what the city said, the method that they should handle these underground vaults. And the result is water below the street sidewalk is channeling into my building. It continues to this day. In fact, groundwater that goes underneath there flows around the adjacent waterproof building and finds a way into my building. I had to run a dehumidifier for 24 hours a day to keep the wall dry. I'm on my second dehumidifier. The first one burnt out. And I also had an engineer come in because in one of the walls there was this white crystalline stuff that kept coming up. And it was the engineer said it was effervescing calcium formed on the walls of the building due to continued moisture penetration from the street water. I've met with City Manager Mathis, Councilman Kespel, and Schmidt. They were all in the building regarding this issue. So at the time, the council agreed that the city damaged my property. This is in 2002. They directed staff to work out a deal with me to make it right. It's been several years since then, and the city staff doesn't feel compelled to act. So essentially what happened is they broke it. I want them to fix it. So what I'm respectfully requesting is the mayor and city council to order the city manager to, one, basically do what was called for in the plan, where there are vaults, cut the section of sidewalk out, and then remove the debris from those vaults underneath it and close the openings with masonry blocks. And this is all in that document I gave you. It's my request. Waterproof the walls of the vaults adjacent to the building. Pour this flowable fill, which is like a thin concrete, into the old vaults. Repave the sidewalk and do it according to the specifications in the city's original construction documents. It can either be done by the city staff itself or they can bid out the project. Because after all, this is only what they were supposed to do in the first place. If this work is done, I'd agree to accept the original tax bill. I have no problem with that. I mean, I'm not even going to seek reimbursement for attorney fees and damages, which were extensive, if we can just get this resolved and you can please direct the city staff to take that action. Please solve this problem. And they created it, and it's very frustrating as a citizen and property owner to have to deal with this. I want this issue to finally, it can end here. It's been 5 years later, and you folks can actually end it here tonight. Thank you.
Anyone else? Seeing none, I'll be the first to comment. Let me say that I was on the council, and I do not recall the council determining that the city was at fault for this. I could be wrong. There are two issues here. One is that there were four or five property owners who benefited from this sidewalk. Five or four?
Four, wasn't it?
Four.
Everybody between 8th and 9th Street on the south side
of Broadway.
Four
owners, Mr. Fagan is one of them. And we agreed to pay half of an improvement which benefited those properties and the city of Columbia, which is why we did it. I do not believe this council has the expertise to determine the cause of his wet basement. I have a wet basement. I wish the council could fix mine. But we don't have the capability to do that. So I'm going to support this bill and urge Mr. Fagan to go through the appropriate proper channels for determining who's at fault. And if the city is at fault, the city will have to fix it like it does on any project that we do, whether it's a street improvement, sewer placement, whatever. I mean, we have proper techniques for managing that. None of those come before the city council because we just simply don't have the expertise to deal with that.
I ask what we have done to address whether it was the city that is causing this water or not. I mean, it's been 5 years. Surely we've looked into this.
Mr. Nose was working with their attorney to come with the resolution, and at this point we have not been able to come to a satisfactory resolve.
Do we know if there was an engineering problem with placing the sidewalk or the actual pouring and construction of the sidewalk?
That has not been determined at this point.
Have we looked into it?
That would be something that we are going to recommend that a claim be filed and those investigations can be done at that time.
But we haven't done it even though it's been 5 years?
We have not pursued, no.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question that kind of relates to this. I guess, and I kind of think I know the answer before I ask the question, but nonetheless, I'd like to posit something. And that is, with respect to the settlement, I assume that the discussions around the settlement that we could not come to agreement with had to do with the amount of money that was necessary to remediate a situation that the city felt that it was not responsible for, but that Mr. Fagan felt they were responsible for. I assume that's the crux of it. Is there any possibility of fashioning some sort of a more or less a compromise proposal such that this tax bill payment could be deferred until such time that there was a potential settlement reached with some sort of deadline date so that there would be some pressure to do that kind of thing?
I believe that's the reason this is back before you, because that was not possible to be negotiated with Mr. Fagan on the staff level. And so staff really believes that if there needs to be a claim made for damage, then there needs to be a claim made for damage, and that this is a tax bill. And we actually have city code provisions that mandate how these tax bills are supposed to be assessed. And so this particular tax bill has been somewhat lingering in the office of the city clerk because we were directed as staff not to assess that pending some sort of attempt at a resolution or compromise between the parties. And that has not been possible based upon those discussions. So that's why that actually landing back in front of you. So I think the council's decision at this point in time is either to assess the tax bill or not to assess the tax bill and cease the lingering, for lack of a better phrase.
And then are you saying that Mr. Fagan needs to sue the city then?
He needs to file a claim. He can certainly file a claim. He can file a claim with the contractor who performed the construction work. He could file a claim with the city. There are all sorts of routes and remedies. We can't necessarily advise him as to what to do, but there are options for him. And if the construction contractor performed poor work, there are options as it relates to that construction contractor as well. But it has nothing to do with the tax bill. You
right.
see those two
yeah,
things. What's
separate.
Happened now is it's become clouded
right.
with the tax bill issue. And the tax bill is a city code requirement, as it in every other property along that stretch has assisted in participation of the construction costs for that sidewalk.
But every other property owner doesn't have water in their basement.
We don't know that. We haven't had any other. We haven't asked, and we haven't had any other complaints. But certainly, we don't know that. It's for council to be put into the position to negotiate the tax bill based upon claims of damage puts you in somewhat of a untenable position. So that's one of the reasons staff really believes that these two issues need to be separate, and that the council should leave the claims up to the administration process and the claims process, and you take a look at the fairness of the tax bill as it relates to the cost of construction and the processes and procedures in place for assessing those tax bills.
Who hired the construction company, though?
The city hires a construction company.
Okay.
Pursuant to bid and bid award.
Okay, and then the city's the one that checks to see if they did what they're supposed to do?
Yes, we have construction inspectors that monitor that work and check the construction activity.
And they did that and felt that it was adequate, or we don't know?
We'd have to follow up with the Public Works Department to determine, you know, exactly who inspected and when and where and how. But, you know, at this point, sitting here, we believe that to be the case, yes.
That's kind of the answer I expected, but it was a little bit more of it than I expected.
Any other discussion? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 356-15, Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
No.
Please read B, 374-15.
Council Bill 374-15 is an ordinance amending Chapter 29 of the City Code as it relates to off-site parking facilities in C2 zoning districts and for fraternity and sorority houses, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
This is a proposed amendment to Chapter 29, which is zoning, Section 30, which is the parking section of the zoning ordinance of the city, and it relates to the location of required parking for what I'll call Greek houses, fraternity or sorority houses, and specifically in an area that we've defined as Greek Town on the west side of the MU campus, east of Providence, between Providence and Tiger Avenue, and north of Kentucky Boulevard to Rollins on the north side. And it's a rule change that would allow Greek houses to include some or all of their required parking up to 1,000 feet off-site. Currently, the zoning code does allow off-site parking within that 1,000-foot radius, but only for non-residential uses. So this would remove that residential exemption in and only in that area that I've described between Rollins and Kentucky and Providence and Tiger Avenue. There's a second part to this ordinance amendment that I'd describe as housekeeping, and that's just changing the location within the ordinance of the C2 residential parking off-site standards. While drafting this ordinance, the law department pointed out that within a required parking table, there were a number of locational standards that really don't fit in that table, and they're better placed in a paragraph called paragraph G. So that's all that's being done there. There is no change to parking requirements in the C2. It's all about, as far as the substantive part of the ordinance, all about the Greek Town area, which is zoned R3 and in some cases R4. This began as a request of the Delta Gamma House for some form of zoning relief to allow them to use a lot that they own that's separate from the existing house location as parking. And they really didn't have any other remedy. Can't do a variance because it would be a use variance other than a text amendment. But this amendment, if approved by council, would apply to any qualifying use within that Greek Town area. try to answer any questions you may have. The Planning and Zoning Commission did recommend this change by a vote of 8-1. And I did want to mention one thing. We did get a request from council to do some research on the parking standard itself for Greek houses. We found that in a sample of 12 communities, just looked at the SEC schools, that Columbia's kind of right in the middle. Our requirement is one parking space for every two occupants of those houses. So report that to you. The Planning and Zoning Commission took that information under advisement. They didn't feel compelled to recommend change of that standard at this time.
Questions?
Yeah, I noticed what the statistic that you just cited in terms of the parking requirements, but in terms of the distance, it also said the report suggested that this was exceeded the limit of that pier site that was the longest. Was that for the reason that you suggested before, that is, administratively, we already have a 1,000-foot limit in place? And
That's correct, and I don't know if we're going to hear from the Delta Gamma representative or not. I believe their original request was actually less. It was either a 600-foot or a 500-foot radius. We did take it upon ourselves to suggest to the Planning and Zoning Commission that 1,000-foot, because that already appears in the ordinance for example, commercial uses.
And that's what PZC saw as well, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And I'd emphasize once again, though, that that off-site parking area has to be within the Greektown area limits as defined. Couldn't be on the west side of Providence Road, for example.
So if passed, this would mean that under R3 and R4 within Greektown, not all of the required parking has to be on site. Any amount of it can be up to 1,000 feet away still within Greektown?
That's correct. Yeah.
Whereas outside of Greektown, R3 and R4 will continue to insist that all of the required parking is on site and not have that. Is there any reason not to just allow this flexibility to all R3 or R4?
We gave that some thought, but really this is where we're seeing the demand for this kind of solution. It's come up in a number of discussions, not only this most recent one. Council might recall the CP zoning we did on Tiger Avenue recently. Alpha Chi Omega, I believe, is the owner of that lot. That was the alternative. And then there have been Board of Adjustment cases where applicants have furnished leases with parking off-site. So it's just an area where we've just seen this activity. And I think the homogeneity of the area, there's over two dozen fraternity and sororities in that area, and there really aren't other land uses present. There's generally not going to be the concern about, for example, a multifamily user generating parking that's then placed on a parking lot in a more mixed density residential area. So,
which would be the concern about,
and that's why we avoided
across the whole city.
That's why we're not recommending to you tonight that we go to College Avenue and recommend the same sort of relief there, where the alternative would be on either side of College Avenue, where there are some Greek houses.
Thanks, Tim.
Can I ask what C2 residential development is?
Yeah, any new residential building in C2 requires parking at a rate of one space for every four bedrooms, and we allow that to be met off-site. So it was part of the interim C2 amendments that were done 2 years ago, and at that time we placed not only that rate of a quarter space for each bedroom, but we also had some locational standards saying it could be met off-site, et cetera, and that's the portion of the requirement that's being moved from 2930B, which is the table of parking requirements, to 2930G, which is location of facilities.
So is this the type of, is the C2 zoning, does this apply to downtown? Because I understood that there was no parking requirement for the C2.
The one exception is for new apartment buildings, and they can meet that requirement on or off site. New residential in a existing building does not have a parking requirement in C2, but any new building, a student housing complex, for example, would have to provide it. It's a low rate. It's one space for every four bedrooms. So,
25%? Okay, thank you.
And Tim, am I right in thinking that the so-called Shakespeare's building is taking advantage of that 1,000-foot rule in their plans?
They've provided documentation that they've purchased spaces and reserved spaces in two different parking garages. Yeah, they're required to have 50 at that one.
Any other questions? Would anyone in the public like to speak?
Good evening. Tom Harrison, Office 1103 East Broadway here in Columbia. I represent the Delta Gamma sorority. I don't really have an affirmative presentation to make. Just want to let you know that I'm here along with a couple of other, pardon me, representatives of Delta Gamma. And I also wanted to thank staff for their cooperation in this. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? We'll close the hearing. I'll start by saying
Janet's coming down.
Pardon me? Oh, okay.
Got one more speaker.
Thank you.
Good to see her.
I'm Janet Hammond. I reside at 1844 Cliff Drive. And while I recognize and appreciate that this is confined to Greektown, I'd like to have it stated on the record that I fear that this could become a creeping solution for the other side of the university campus. As you know, East Campus hosts at least 8 fraternities and sororities, and there's another one on the west side of College Avenue. I don't know if that's what I said. But on the East Campus side of College, there's 8. So I would not like to see this new stipulation be transposed at some future date to all fraternities and sororities. And I'm hoping that stating this on the record can help some years in the future keep this from happening. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? I'll start by saying I view this as a local solution to a local problem. Greektown is fairly homogeneous. The east side of College is not. And I would view it, you know, it's not going to come up in the next 3 months, but I would think that I would think that any future council would view it in the framework that Ms. Hammond presented. In that case, I'm going to support this. Any other comments? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 374-15, Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Reffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
376.
Council Bill 376 is an ordinance authorizing a joint funding agreement with the U.S. Geological Survey, United States Department of the Interior, for groundwater monitoring of well sites in the vicinity of the wetland treatment units in the Eagle Bluffs Conservation Area, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
This ordinance is requesting an agreement for the City of Columbia to contract with the United States Geological Survey for continued groundwater monitoring in the McMain Bottoms. This water quality and hydrologic monitoring has been conducted since 1992. This is an annual agreement for year 2 of the 6-year plan for the continued groundwater monitoring by United States Geological Survey. The cost of this contract is split between the sewer and the water divisions, with the sewer paying 80% of this cost and the water paying the other 20% of this contract. And with that, to answer any questions about this ordinance request for agreement.
Council?
I don't have any questions.
I just have one question. Was any of this that has come before the council passed through the Water and Light Advisory Board? Was that ever considered?
There's been a lot of discussion at on the Water and Light Advisory Board about the monitoring and the water quality samples and the results and everything. We went through recently just some well siting that all this information was reviewed with the Water and Light Advisory Board when we looked at those wells.
Would anyone from the public like to speak? Council discussion. I view this as just a requirement of service. I mean, it's you have to do it.
Bob, I'd like to actually propose that we refer this to the Water and Light Advisory Board before moving forward with this contract. I've had a request from a member of the Water and Light Advisory Board to look at it. As I understand it, there is a recommendation under source water protection monitoring to identify a chemical fingerprint of the water treatment wetlands, and there's an opportunity to modify the scope of work of this contract with USGS to address that task force recommendation. I would propose that we table this this bill for as long as it takes a couple of months in order to refer it to the Water and Light Advisory Board so they can look at it and see if they would like to recommend changes to the scope of work to address that task force recommendation.
Date was for October 1, 15 to September 30. Could we proceed on continuing what we're doing today? Would that bother you any if we continued the monitoring and bring the agreement back like you want it? We could always add that in. I think we need to continue our monitoring so we have the same data set that we've had for the last 20 years, and so we have the monitoring set on the same time. I think if we skip anything or we change something here, we may not get a sample that we might have wanted.
Or if you do, but isn't this a new contract for another 5-year period or something like
it's
that?
It's the second year. It's yes.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't say you should stop doing anything that you're doing or stop the USGS doing anything they're doing right now. But before we sign another contract, we have Water and Light Board look at the scope of work, and maybe they'll be happy to go ahead with the procedure exactly as it has been. But since they haven't seen it this time around, and they said that this same analysis has been happening for 20, 25 years, mm-hmm. and then it may not be completely relevant now, or there may be other things they want to bring in, ask that they could take a look at
it. We've added some stuff over the years. It's about, you know, protecting the water source. You're exactly right. That's why we do it. We want to make sure our sewers are not polluting our water source
into
for
the
sure,
drinking water,
as well as the wetlands from the conservation. So no problem, we can do that.
Okay,
as long
so
as we can continue on monitoring as we're doing today.
Yeah, I wasn't kind of putting out an injunction, but just saying, can we table this particular vote on a new okay, so I'm going to make that motion.
For a second.
I'll second that motion.
Discussion on the motion to table.
The table too.
How
long would you need?
Well, the next board meeting is Wednesday this week, and since the agenda is all posted, I don't think we'll be able to officially get it on that agenda. So you're looking at the February board meeting before we could even get it considered. And
so we're looking
how
at
long
two
after
months.
That you think it would take?
Table it for 2 months.
Meeting in March.
I just need to clarify with staff: we cannot authorize any actions under the contract until the contract's been approved and you have funding for it. Is that correct?
Well, this says it's from October of 15 to September of 16.
And you're already in January of 2016. So if
you
delay
say
for another.
So you're already working under this contract that hasn't been approved by council?
I don't know. I don't know when the monitoring starts. That's the problem. It may be spring monitoring, and that's what I don't have in here, when they do monitoring.
Could we go ahead and approve this and ask that it go
sure,
between the
that.
Water?
That would be my preference.
Okay.
Board, and that the next time this comes up, then they will have had a chance to weigh in because it's only a two-year contract.
If we could bring back a recommendation from the advisory board of how they'd like to see this contract added to, amended, changes, I think that would probably pacify both parties here.
Yeah, it comes to you every year.
That would be the prudent thing to do. But one additional tidbit, and I think it might be fair game to, and only fair, to also at least give some of this information to the Environment and Energy Commission so they may have an opinion. It's another one of our advisory groups. I think they should get it before we act on it.
So I'll withdraw my motion to table, and just to confirm, you'll get this on the agenda of the February Water
right.
and Light Board meeting. Okay.
Thanks. And a second.
I think it's particularly important that this monitoring be done seasonally and timely. I mean, you do not want to throw in seasonal variations into the monitoring given the flow of water. So. The amendment is withdrawn. Any other discussion? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 376-15, Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
377?
Council Bill 377-15 is an ordinance appropriating funds for integrated water resource planning services and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff.
An integrated resource plan is a utility plan for meeting forecasted peak and annual demand through a combination of supply-side and demand-side resources. Staff has been working with the Water and Light Advisory Board to complete a contract with a consultant to create an integrated resource plan for the water utility, or what is known as an integrated water resource plan. This process is designed to generate a long-range plan to serve as a guidance document for the water utility. It is staff's expectation that this process and the resulting planning document will be completed prior to the development and finalization of the capital improvement plan to be funded by the next water utility bond. We have been working with the Water and Light Advisory Board to develop the scope of services for this consultant contract and expect to begin this planning process early in 2016. At the last council meeting, the structure was approved for the Integrated Water Resource Planning Committee that will interface directly with this process. This is the same approach that was taken to create the Integrated Resource Plan for the electric utility. So at this time, I'd like to answer any questions about what we're doing with this plan formation.
Yeah, so I asked for this one to be taken off as well. So has an RFP been issued for this contract?
Yes, it has.
It's already been issued?
Mm-hmm.
And has the contract been awarded?
No.
Okay. Is the RFP in the documentation?
The scope of services is.
And the proposal by the success, or the you've decided who you want to award it to?
We're still in the evaluation phase, but the scope of services, you know, we don't have an award yet because we have to work through purchasing to get an award, and there's the issues with defining who the awardee is before it's been finalized. So you can't make the award without, you know, we can't disclose all the people that are bid on who the leading candidate is before it's been finalized. So we gave you a scope of services to let you know what we expect to achieve with this, and the funding estimate is based upon who we think is going to be the successful bidder with this.
Okay. And you haven't finally made that determination yet, but the purpose of this bill is to make the money available so that you can award that contract.
Right. We feel like we're close enough now that we can give you what we feel is a really close scope of services, what we expect to accomplish, and how much money we need to get this done.
And if you wouldn't mind just taking a couple of minutes to summarize what the specific skills and experience that the consultant brings to this particular work.
Well, certainly. The main point of this is basically to take a lot of the plans that we have in place, because we've done a lot of planning. We have a plan that takes a look at the expansion of the water treatment plant. It also takes a look at the current assessment of the treatment plant. We do water distribution modeling, and we got well site studies. We got a lot of pieces to this, so we're looking at a consultant that not only generates these but has done these type of reports. And one of the big things that was important to us as we were interviewing them is the interface with the public. This process, as I've indicated when we put the committee together, is going to need public interface. There's going to be a lot of it. So one of the things we want to do is have a firm that's proficient at interfacing and communicating with the public and getting the information that the public provides us, somehow putting it together and developing a concise plan based upon all these different inputs from staff, the community. This is going to be a fairly long, extensive project that's going to take somebody that's done this before, primarily interfacing with the public with this. So this is the first time we've gone through this approach with the water side. I think it's a good time for us to go through this approach, and that's one of the things we're looking at is somebody that's done this before.
And the committee that we approved with a resolution at the last meeting will work with the consultant and oversee the scope of services.
They will work directly with the consultant on this. So they will have meetings that group is part of. And just like we did on the electric side, there's staff, the consultant, and this group that we all work together to work through this and go through the public hearings, the public meetings, go through the whole process together.
How long do you anticipate the project will take?
We're hoping to have the plan document completed by the end of this year, because our funding opportunities for water that we'd like to have this all put together are going to be in 2017, most likely.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Any other questions? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Any discussion by council? Please call the roll. Oh,
if I could
you are make a comment.
Been so quiet.
I haven't said anything all night. I really like the idea of an IRP. I think it works really well with electric. I've gotten some constituent feedback because there is a perception that we We hire a lot of consultants, and $450,000 looks like a lot of money, but it's a huge undertaking to take a total look at a system, and that we are putting ourselves in a position to be able to save that much money more through, you know, if we can avoid building another expensive water treatment plant or expanding it. So I think there's a lot of things in regards to improving conservation, looking at non-potable source. It looks like a great, good scope of work, and it seems very much like, you know, a thoughtful, let's, you know, really figure out what's going on and how we can position ourselves for the future. So I plan to support this.
I'll just piggyback onto that because we all have been in the city, us and staff have been criticized for lack of planning. Mm-hmm. And the city does utilize a lot of third-party expertise. We've got some very highly talented professionals at the city I've met and come to know. But there are some issues that are very complex that require outside expertise. And that's part of the planning process. And it costs money to bring those people in. So I'm pleased that we're ahead of the wave on this one. And I think this is a great proposal.
Just one comment. That is, I mean, the electric plant, as Mr. Trapp suggested, has been working pretty well. I think it was a great outcome for it. And certainly conservation is a very positive thing. It reminds me of the virtual power plant idea. This could be the virtual water plant idea. And it certainly is a way to save the taxpayers untold amounts of money if we can effectively use the kinds of gray water systems and so on and so forth that I suspect will be forthcoming out of this report.
Yeah. Anybody else? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 377-15, Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
385-15.
Council Bill 385-15 is an ordinance authorizing a property transfer agreement with the curators of the University of Missouri relating to city-owned property located at the corner of 5th Street and Locust Street and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
This particular legislation would request approval of an ordinance to transfer property, city-owned property, located at 5th and Locust Street to the University of Missouri. In terms of a little background to this, about 4 years ago, the city entered into a memorandum of understanding with the university related to the construction of the State Historical Society building here in Columbia, subject to the State Historical actually acquiring funding from the state, which they have recently done. State Historical Society would build the proposed building on a lot that's owned by the University of Missouri, located at 6th and Elm. It would displace all of the university parking currently on that particular piece of property. So the agreement with the city was to basically transfer this piece of property to them, which would accommodate, I think, about half of the parking they currently have. So obviously this is a pretty valuable community project, the value that this Historical Society building would bring to Columbia. So this particular agreement is really kind of a fulfillment of that understanding that we gained 4 years ago. The legislation, the agreement that you have in front of you has been the subject of some discussion, I think, as late as today in terms of the way that the property is actually transferred to the university. The original agreement that you had that was presented at the time of the agenda suggested that we transfer the property via quitclaim deed, which is a valid way to transfer property. City has not had an opportunity to really research any of the title or the easements or any of the various properties that make up that particular parcel. So the suggestion was that we do that via quitclaim deed. I think the university has requested that we transfer that property via a warranty deed, and I think you have an amendment in front of you that would do that. It changes the language, I think you'll see on page 2. Is that correct, Nancy?
Yes, paragraph 1.
Paragraph 1, where you'll actually see the word quitclaim deed replaced with the word warranty deed. So it's basically at this point, I think, up to council whether or not you wish to make that amendment.
I got a call from Vice Chancellor Ward today. His legal team strongly wants a warranty deed. Now, I'm not a lawyer, praise the Lord, And I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn last night. But the warranty deed, as I understand it, when they get conferred the land, they want basically a guarantee from us that we actually own the land, right? That's basically that we own clear title to it, and that we have a right to give it to them, whatever. But that's what they want. This is a time-sensitive transaction. There is bonding to occur in the immediate near future to get this thing underway, and this has been kind of batted around for a long time, and I on that basis, I'm going to recommend that we amend this per the amendment sheet, which transfers it via warranty deed. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Can I ask a question about that? And I just did briefly, I too am not an attorney, and I would appreciate just a slight rundown of what the distinction between the warranty deed and the quitclaim deed, and does that have any at all taxpayer or city exposure?
Well, with the warranty deed, you warrant that you will defend the title and will ensure the title. With a quitclaim deed, what you do is you pass along the title that you currently exist. That you currently have in the piece of property without making any warranty or insurance as to title. You just pass along the title that you get, so you don't warrant the existing title or future title. And since this is not a cash transaction, this is simply a transfer of title. The suggestion in the agreement that was provided to council was that you just transfer what you have in the property by transferring it via quitclaim deed, that you don't warrant and insure that. The university wants a warranty deed, and if you are so inclined, you can grant a warranty deed. We will warrant and defend that title as it's passed along. It's a little bit more complicated as it relates to the alley transfer, because the alley transfer, we actually have to go through a street vacation process for the alley. You currently don't have a fee simple title to the alley, and they have requested that you provide certainly a warranty deed with regard to both tracks. So that's what the amendment before you provides. It provides that, and then it also says that the transfer will be subject to any existing utility easements. So that modification was also made.
So it's slightly more work, in other words, from a layman's perspective.
It's not just more work, it's certainly more risk for the city, because we haven't done any title investigation to know what the history of any of these pieces of property is. That history, in some of the instances over on the parking garage tract in particular, there were at least one, if not two, parcels that were taken by condemnation. We certainly don't have a lot of history, and we don't have any warranties from the prior owner that we can pass along. Those that we obtained by warranty deed, those warranties certainly transfer as part of the title process. But we certainly didn't get a warranty deed on those that we got that we condemned the property on, and we don't have that as it relates to the alley. So you are guaranteeing title when you enter into an agreement to. And you transfer title via warranty.
I mean, these are important actors, but is a warranty deed, is that a common phenomenon, or is this an uncommon phenomenon? Or?
No, certainly it's a common, a warranty deed is how you typically would transfer property. Quitclaim deeds are also common phenomenons. Special warranty deeds are a type of deed where you only transfer and warrant the title while you had it was good. You don't warrant basically the history or the title history of a particular a parcel. I think any of those things, those title issues are things that we can overcome as a city. The question is who bears the risk and the responsibility for doing that, and who bears the burden of showing that title is good and the expense of that.
Thank you.
So if this has been getting batted around for 4 years, why have we not done a title search? Why is this a surprise, and why is this time sensitive and that it needs to be done and rushed through tonight?
It's time sensitive in that
I got the bond thing.
Yeah, well, that's it. If they don't get the money will be for this project will come from a bond sale which has to be done within a month.
Okay.
There's no certainty that it's going to get done. This is really a very fragile process, actually, with a lot of different constituents involved in putting this together.
But a title search isn't a fragile thing, and we've had 4 years to do. I mean, I'm not saying I wouldn't.
I can't explain that. I don't know.
Right.
We don't even have to turn to the city
and say, why have we not looked at this? Why is this a surprise?
It's interesting. We don't actually have a legal description for this piece of property either. We don't have a survey. It's never been subdivided. So if you had to take the track that the parking garage that the city constructed is, you have a series of tracks, and it was actually constructed over lot lines on a series of tracks and constructed on partial tracks. And it's the remainder of those tracks that there was this commitment via a not, and it was actually done through a non-binding memorandum of understanding. And I think the parties were all clear at the time. It was a non-binding memorandum of understanding that everyone has treated as a somewhat binding and in a commitment. A firm commitment to convey this piece of property. So you flash forward to what I don't even know, 4 years into the MOU. I wasn't here when it happened. So
right,
it all came as a surprise to me, honestly.
Okay.
So
yeah, it was like 2010, according to the documents.
It happened before the city manager was here and some current staff. So you flash forward to today, and we're sitting here with a piece of property that you have this commitment under the memorandum of understanding to convey that there has never been any title work done on, never been any survey work done on, and we're in a rush to get that done due to funding obligations that are coming from the state of Missouri,
right,
for the State Historical Society project.
But I mean, I heard about this last month, so if I heard about it, why did the city not hear about it? I mean, why do we not have time to have done this properly, is I guess my question.
When it first came to me, it came to me as a parking transfer agreement, as a request for a parking transfer agreement. I would say the actual conveyance of real estate, it probably mid-December.
And we haven't had time to do a title search in that?
That really wasn't part of the process or examination for purposes of the transfer of the agreement. First thing you have to do is work out the transfer and whether or not council actually wants to transfer the agreement, and then you move forward with all of those details.
Just to provide a little bit more background, hopefully, to answer your question.
I believe the university may have done title work, by the way. I don't.
They very well might have.
Did the title? I'm sorry. You tell us what.
Well, what I know is that the original memorandum of understanding, as Nancy said, was non-binding, and it was really just trying to find a way to accommodate the loss of parking that the university was going to incur. Yeah. Up until most recently, before this draft, which has only been out for a month, if that, not even that, maybe. Very recently,
late third week in December,
the original negotiations that were occurring between the city and the university was basically to accommodate their parking in other ways than that lot. We thought we had another solution with accommodating some of their parking in the 6th and Walnut garage, and maybe, or the 5th and Walnut garage, and potentially the 6th and Cherry garage. It was only very recently that this turned into an agreement to transfer the property.
I don't think that's right. You might be right, but I'm the only person on the council that was here in March of 2011.
But up until recently, the just
but that transfer of property was very clear in that non-binding memorandum of understanding.
Yeah,
that's true.
What I thought.
But
I
recent discussions certainly changed.
But again,
the focus.
The non-binding deal that we signed clearly was a transfer of property, and I remember how it came up. It came up really out of the blue to me. We had an interim city manager at the time, and the former city manager had negotiated this, basically, with the Columbia Daily Tribune publisher and the university. It was a very sensitive discussion because the location was all on university land, and they didn't want to give up their land. And they had 128 parking spots on there, and so they agreed to give up the land consistent with half that if we would backfill that other half. So what it ended up being is, and in lieu of them donating the whole land, we were backfilling half of it. The land has value, and so we are basically saying that we are dismissing the value of this property because we think it's the city as a whole is better off with this Missouri State Historical Society structure. And it was on that basis that I agreed to go along with it. It certainly was never certain in 2011 they'd get the funding.
Right.
And the funding came through, and it's not clear that funding will stay. That's part of the time sensitivity of this.
Yeah, and I think that's a good idea. It took me a while to figure this out when I was doing this, and I thought, well, wait, this is an advantage to the city to have the state historical. So this is great. I'm just sort of frustrated that the city's going to take liability, and the response is we haven't had time to do a title search. Anytime there's a title search.
But this is part of the land that the parcels that we have our garage on.
Yeah.
So as you say, we built a garage on some of this. So if there's a problem on a couple of those lots, that goes under, we're going to have to sell the part of the garage, I guess.
I think the question is really who is going to do the work. As I said, a quick claim deed, which was the proposal you got originally, is a valid way to transfer property. The question is, do we do all of the necessary work, or does the university do the necessary work to provide title?
Right.
And we're transferring a piece of property that's worth a lot more than it was 5 years ago. This is a $4.2 million piece of property, and I certainly understand the benefits that accrue to the city by doing this. I think we all understand that. But really, the quick claim deed that we had proposed would have transferred that particular property in a legal manner to the university. Then they could have done whatever needed research was needed to make sure that they have secure title to it.
Let me just say that I've not been involved in a negotiation, and the conversation I have had with people at the university who can speak to this tell me that their legal department, over which they have no control, requires a warranty deed for this transaction to go through.
And I think we're happy to do that.
There are several time-sensitive issues here, and not the least of which is the bonding piece, but also there is a political piece, too. We want to make sure that this happens. I was here with the previous city manager when we were talking about the State Historical Society, which was located in the library, consistent with the Sasaki plan and lots of other plans in terms of the whole museum district, if you will, on that end of town. So I think it's reasonable to assess the risk here for this property, but it has to be balanced with the risk of this not happening. In my opinion, overwhelmingly, the economic benefit of this outweighs that risk.
So what we have right now, we're in the discussion on the amendment.
The amendment.
Right. So shall we vote on the amendment sheet?
Right, and this is the moment.
Right, this basically means that we will convey a warranty deed to the university.
Right. And it also adds, just so that you know, the only other thing that it does, it adds the language that we talked about, and then it also adds the description of the two pieces of property in B1 and B2. The university still needs to provide a legal description of the university property, which is not included or has not yet been provided.
Right. I want to clarify. Well, let's deal with the amendment first. All in favor of the amendment sheet, say aye.
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 Opposed, say no. Let me ask a question now.
Did anybody say no?
I don't think anybody did. If this would fall through for whatever reason, and there's so many moving parts here, I hope it is successful, but this transfer is contingent only on a culmination of State Historical Society being built. Am I correct about that?
It provides that once the state provides a construction commencement date, that you will transfer the property no sooner than 90 days and no less than 30 days prior to that construction commencement date.
Okay.
It does not specifically address, because it's not State Historical Society is not a party to the agreement, so it does not specifically address occupancy and operation by the State Historical Society, simply construction of the building.
Well, it's kind of late in the game, but are we protected?
I think you could be better protected, but this is what you have. It meets the terms of the MOU for transfer of the agreement.
Well, before we discuss this, let's see if anybody in the public wants to speak. Does anybody in the public want to speak?
Sorry,
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, my name is Gary Kramer, and I'm the director of the State Historical Society, so I clearly have an interest, though, okay. As you indicate, we're not a party to this. There is urgency. The Missouri Development Finance Board, which will issue the bonds ultimately, is insisting that we have everything to them by the end of this month, all the signed documents, all the agreements. So there's really no time to fool around. We've been talking about this for a long time. And you may remember, Mr. Mayor, that what prompted a lot of this discussion was the suggestion 4 years ago that the State Historical Society be moved from Columbia to Jefferson City. That was a serious proposal. They were going to move us in the prison. We'd all have cells. This was part of the discussion of the prison redevelopment, and the land was going to be free and so forth. We think that the State Historical Society needs to be situated in close proximity to a major research institution. We love our Columbia home. We've been here since 1898. We want to stay. And I don't want to get into the weeds of the discussion about warranty claim or warranty deed versus quitclaim deed. I just want to get it done. And I want to get it done ideally tonight, if at all possible, so that the MDFB will not move forward until we have signed agreements from all the parties involved on all the issues involved. And so I would respectfully request that you take this on and approve this resolution. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Will there be a public museum as part of the new building?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. We are now a public museum, and we are by statute prohibited from charging admission. So it will be free and open to the public. We think that there will be a dramatic increase in the number of people coming to use that. We think it will, in fact, become a destination point. We have a world-class art collection. In our current facility, we can display less than one quarter of 1%, less than one quarter of 1% of our world-class art collection of Thomas Hart Benton and George Cable Bingham paintings. It's a crime. It's a crime against Missourians that this material is not readily available for them. School kids can't get to us. Parking is horrendous because of the closed campus. So we desperately need this. We think it will benefit the citizens of Columbia, the citizens of the state of Missouri.
Well said. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Mayor and council members, I'm Brian Burnett. I'm the University of Missouri System Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, and I'm here to support this as well. Last month at the curators meeting, they gave me permission to execute a 99-year lease on the property for this project, subject to the City of Columbia coming through with the deal that was inked back in 2011. I've been here about 18 months, so I've been catching up quickly about this project. I can tell you I come from the state of Colorado, and a building like this that we built in Colorado has been just phenomenal for the history of the state of Colorado, and I encourage you to think about what this means for Columbia, the state of Missouri, and the students of the future understanding the history of our state. So I'm happy to take any questions. As Gary said, time is of the essence. There are four separate agreements between the campus, the State Historical Society. The curators are the fiscal agent for the State Historical Society. Their appropriation from the state comes to the curators. Doesn't go to any of our campuses. It goes straight to them. But we are the fiscal agent, so we'll be managing this project for them. We are the intermediary with the state, and we're the intermediary with the campus. So we stand in support of this and urge your action tonight.
Can you give us any information about the size of the building you're hoping to build and how much will be able to be displayed and a time frame for when this would be completed?
They just started the programming today, in fact, with architects. The building, the plot that the curators are dedicating to this is about twice the size of the land that the city would be giving back to the curators. What I would say is we're hoping for 35,000 feet, 100,000, 35,000 is what they have in Ellis now, more like 100,000 square feet, sorry. But we have to see where the budget goes. The state bonding authority is $35 million. We're looking at a budget between $35 and $40 million, working with the Historical Society and their board. But
a multiple-story building?
It will likely at least have multiple stories, yes. But we're looking at how it can fit in with that architecture of the campus, and they just began that programming today. So it's early. But again, as Gary said, we're not going to be able to get the state finance authority to move on executing those bonds if we can't show the administration in Jeff City that we have all these agreements and our ducks in a row here in Columbia. That's simple.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? If not, we'll go to council comments. I enthusiastically endorse this. This is a generational opportunity that I am confident this council will not miss. Look very forward to the completion of this museum.
Just one comment. As the mayor might say on occasion, promises made, promises kept. I wasn't on the council at the time when this non-binding promise was made, although I was sitting there listening to it. I can remember when I was not on the council. This is too important. There is a bit of the risk here. The risk has been described, but it's also very risky not to go ahead with this. We've been talking about this for a long time. The benefits to not only economic development but cultural development as well, and the arguments made are very compelling. I'll be very, very happy to support this.
Pleased to see the legislator came through with the funding. This is something that we've been talking about the entire time that I've been on council. If you haven't had a chance, the Historical Society gave council a tour, got us up to speed in regards to the MOU some years ago, and kind of talked about their kind of hopes and dreams for the building. I'm sure that they would be amenable if you want to find more information about what they're doing. I think it's a really important thing to keep that resource in Columbia. I think it's going to really add to the ambiance of downtown to have another attraction. I think it just enriches all of us as a community, and it's in the city's particular interest to see that this kind of statewide enterprise stays here in Columbia. So understand as we, get into negotiation processes to try to get the best, deal for Columbia. And so some of that, looking at alternatives to the transfer of property, that would have been worth pursuing, because it'd be nice to get the Historical Society and still have our valuable piece of land. But it is most important that we, honor our relationships and move forward to make sure this project happens.
I think it's important that we don't overlook the fact that this is an important aspect of economic development for the community as well. It is bound to generate an increase in income and tourism and various aspects that will certainly help our city. I've used the Historical Society resources for many years, and I can attest to how difficult it is to navigate the collection and get access to the collection. And now that I'm retired, parking has become an issue. And so I certainly champion this project and look forward to being here to see it completed.
Please call the roll.
Council Bill 385-15 as amended. Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
386.
Council Bill 386-15 is an ordinance amending Chapter 9 of the City Code as it relates to fire sprinkler systems in fraternity and sorority buildings and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
Good evening. On August 17th of 2015, a report to Council was produced concerning fraternity and sorority requests for extensions to the fire sprinkler requirement. As a result of that discussion, Council requested that the Fire Department return to Council with suggested modifications to City Ordinance 9-22, Section 903.2.8.3. A summary of the Fire Department's suggested modifications. We suggest modification of the original deadline from March 16th, 2016. To June 1st, 2016, to better align with the end of the semester. We would like to add the requirement that those original fraternities and sorority buildings that cannot meet the June 1, 2016 deadline must submit a plan to achieve compliance to the fire chief and receive approval of that plan prior to the June 1st, 2016 deadline. Fire chief will review the plans, establish appropriate benchmarks, identify additional safety measures, and if the plan is approved, establish a deadline specific to that property not to exceed 3 years in duration or June 1st of 2019. Written quarterly reports will be required if an extension is granted. And if a fraternity or sorority disagrees with the requirements established by the fire chief, a written request for review and variance may be requested from the city council. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Council? Would anyone from the public like to speak?
Mayor, Council, good evening. Thank you for your service for the community. My name is Tom O'Neill. I'm a resident of Columbia about a dozen years now, and in my spare time, of which there isn't much because I'm still full-time job at the university as a fundraiser, I assist at the Kappa Alpha Order fraternity, which is on the corner of College and University, the north corner. When this bill first came up, I pointed out to the council at that time that when you raise funds, you usually ask for a five-year pledge, and they actually were nice enough to extend the time through 2016. We did and I've written you a letter. I thought that I was advised to be here on the 21st, and then they said, well, no, they're going to do a reading, so come this time. But as I expressed in the letter, we did what's called a feasibility study to find out if we could raise enough money. It's going to take about $1 million to renovate the house and include the sprinklers. The house is like 60 years old, still standing, which is good. And at that time, it indicated from our alumni that if we did a campaign, we could probably raise about $1 million. And we got that information just as the market started to crash. And we went into a recession, as everybody knows. And I'm at the university. I know that our fundraising went down. And we decided to put that on hold because while people will tell you at one time when their stocks, their 401ks are in good shape, that they'll give you $25,000 over 5 years, when their stock, their 401 goes down to 70% of what they had when they talked to you, that's not going to happen. So we put it on hold for a while, and then last year started another an updated feasibility. Feasibility means that you have a fundraising company that you pay to go out and talk to some of your alums that have the capacity to help you out. At Kappa Alpha, we're a great fraternity. We don't have the alumni base that people like the Beta has. As you probably know, they had four people that covered about half of their cost of $12 million. We're not in that ballpark. So we did find out that we probably still could raise $1 million. So we've started with the construction plans. I'm just about at the stage of getting a 501c3 charitable foundation established so that for some of the people we can give a charitable deduction, at least for the educational part of it. We're in the process of doing a cash flow to see if we can start in summer of 2017 and probably go through that fall semester. It's going to take about 6 months probably to do this. It'll be a major renovation. We're going to have to do the HVAC, all the walls, the flooring, the ceiling, the plumbing, and electrics. Total renovation, which will include, obviously, a good sprinkler system. I have yet to meet with a banker. They were on board. Central Bank was on board when we looked at this in 2007. I think they'll do it again, but have to borrow about $1.2 million from the bank and tell them you have pledges for about $1 million that'll be paid over 5 years, but you don't have that money in the bank. You only get about 40% of it if you're lucky the first year. And that may be too much of a stretch for us, in which case we'd have to then put it off to 2018. I don't want to do that, but that's the reality where we are as of today. I don't think we have a fire safety issue at our house. We do the fire inspections. We always pass those. The house has been there 60 years. We've never had a fire. We don't allow any smoking. We're pretty careful about this in the house. We did upgrade from individual alarm system to put in a central alarm system. When we realized we were going to have to delay the campaign, we did put in a central alarm system that goes into the fire department. Given a couple of false alarms, but no problems. So I don't think there's a risk issue there. I hope that you'll pass this, and we'll look forward to working with the fire department to try to get together a plan to do this as soon as we can, hopefully by the summer of 17, but we may need another time. You try to do it during the summer in one semester. If you close it for the year, you're knocking kids out. You're putting them into apartments that don't have sprinklers anyway, but you're also pulling out from your income from doing that. So that, try to do this in 3 minutes. I hope the letter that I'd sent will help, but I'd be glad to answer any questions if anybody has some concerns. Or I'm the guy in the trenches, so feel free to ask any questions that might be helpful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Quick.
My name is Scott Evans. I'm the chapter director for Sigma Pi Fraternity at the University of Missouri. I, too, was originally going to come on the 21st and pushed off to today. Based on the reading that I heard, it appears most of what I was going to discuss might be more appropriate to discuss with the fire department should tonight's motion pass here. I was coming to ask for a variance on our annex. We have two properties, the annex and our... For our fraternity, this is the first year we've had it, and we rent from a landlord who does not or did not plan on installing any type of sprinkler system. It's a residence that we put 18 people in that I think slightly exceeds the 16-man limit for the requirement. And we did not have any attrition this semester, which is a good thing. We had originally planned on not having an issue getting down under the 16 so that we would be okay for this upcoming semester. We've had everybody returning, so we have 18 people in that house, and we were originally asking for a variance, but it sounds like if this passes, that would be with the fire department. We have plans in place when renegotiating our lease for next year. We made it a point to require from the landlord that he was going to install the sprinkler system, and we increased our rent to help offset some of his cost because this was important to us. You know, I actually discussed with someone at the fire department. I don't know if he's here tonight. And I think when I mentioned it, he said, well, we didn't even know this house existed. So this is us bringing forth another home that I guess if I would have kept my mouth shut, we wouldn't have had a problem. But we've been very proactive. We have a plan in place. We negotiated our rent with the intention of the sprinkler system being put in over the summer. The landlord has entered a contract with the company to do so. So that way when fall rolls around, we're okay. But we are not going to be able to get under that 16-man limit until August, maybe over the summer, but we have a lot of out-of-state guys that try to work with in-state tuition. You know, our home, our fraternity house is compliant. We've done everything. We've had people come out and inspect. We've done everything that we need to do with this. And I really am seeking a variance until August of 2015. For our annex, you know, I could easily not do anything, say anything, but then if there were an issue and we had 17 people living in there, I know that what kind of trouble we would be in. So we're trying to take the right steps, and we would ask that you consider to give us that leeway, as this was something that came up about a month ago for us. So if anybody has any questions, I'm happy to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? We'll move to... Council discussion. Yeah, well, let's face it, we are concerned about safety for our citizens, and there are fire codes, and we have a very competent fire department. And what this does is it's a challenge for some of these houses to come up with the money to come up to code. I mean, these are older homes, but they've got to do it. And what this does is create a process where they can talk to our professionals and work it out. And I'm confident that this is a process that'll work very well. And I think it's a needed process. Anyone else?
Yeah, just, I mean, if the chief has recommended this as some of these options, that are workable options with the folks who need some help in the interim until they come up to compliance, I'm certainly willing to go along with that.
Please call the roll.
Council Bill 38615, Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Please read the consent agenda bills.
Items on the consent agenda include bills 373-15, 375-15, 378-15, 380-15, 381-15, 382-15, 383-15, 384-15, and resolutions 116, 216, 316, 416.
Call the roll, please.
Bills 373-15, 375-15, 378-15, 380-15, 381-15, 382-15, 383-15, 384-15, and resolutions 116, 216, 316, 416. Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes, on all bills and resolutions.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Please read the introduction and first reading bills.
All bills are introduced by the mayor unless otherwise indicated. Bills 116, 216, 316, 416, 516, 616, 716, 816, 916, 1016, and 1116, first reading.
The first report, 1-16, is a report from the Downtown Community Improvement District Board of Directors. The Board of Directors issues a slate of officers. That slate must be approved by the City Council. They have a resignation, and they have recommended Steve Guthrie to fill in that slot. And on that basis, I move to approve Steve Guthrie to the CID Board of Directors. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Report 216 is correspondence from Parks and Rec. They are supposed to put one person on the Bicycle Pedestrian Commission, and they're having trouble getting somebody to do it, frankly. And so that what they are suggesting is that they not be required to put somebody on Bike Ped Commission. That would make it a 9-member commission, which is an odd number, and in fact be replaced with a city staff member. It makes sense to me. I'm interested in what the other council members have to say about it.
As I read it, it looked as if we're saying that a Parks and Rec staff member would actually be a member of the Bicycle Pedestrian
Commission. Non-voting member.
A non-voting member. Are there other examples of staff members being non-voting members of commissions?
Yes.
We have 3 members on the DLC that are ex officio members.
Okay. Great. Yeah. Well, it looks like a good solution then.
Well, should we make a motion to ask staff to approve this change?
We'd have to bring back legislation, so you'd
That's
be directing
what I'm asking.
Us. Yeah.
I'm asking staff to come back with legislation to approve this change. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Report 3 has to do with putting a canopy over Country Club Missouri Tennis Court. And what they're recommending is a zoning regulation which allows them to do that. I'll turn this over to you.
Yeah, this would just initiate an amendment to the zoning ordinance that would classify a domed structure or air-supported structure or tennis bubble, as the attorney's letter refers to it, as a conditional use. Currently in R1 districts where the country club is situated, only outdoor pool and tennis clubs are permitted use by conditional use, which means the Board of Adjustment would examine each and every instance to determine if it's an appropriate location or if there, in fact, are some conflicts with that. So it would just make the definition of tennis club a little more flexible, could allow a dome-type structure to be placed over the courts. These are also regulated by the fire code, so they're referred to as membrane structures, so there are life safety requirements that would apply here, too. This go to the Planning and Zoning Commission, then come back in the form of an ordinance for council to consider.
If I could just have a question. I like this idea. I like to play tennis. I wish it were public courts as well as private. But nonetheless, there is a structure on the east side of town, south of I-70, yeah, which is a dog, essentially dog performance building too. That's an air inflated building, or at least it's supported to some
degree. Yeah, I've been in that structure, yeah. and there's a superstructure to it, uh-huh. And that one would have been built in accordance with the International Building Code. It's a year round.
Okay, that's the distinction here.
This one's actually proposed to be a limit of 180 days, so it's really a seasonal structure. Okay. And it comes out of that same part of the fire code that deals with tents, the special event tents and things
like
that.
Like Bengals and some of these others.
Yeah, and there, it's kind of a tiered approach to construction requirements. The dome structures are required to have two exits minimum, and then as the occupancy levels go up, more exits, self-closing doors to limit air leakage and things of that nature.
May I have a motion directing staff to prepare necessary text changes and to refer this to the Planning and Zoning Commission for a public hearing?
So moved. Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Report four is a report from the Smart Growth Parking group. I think Mr. Thomas and Council Member Ruffin were on this task force, Trapp. Am I correct?
No, it was he and I, Barbara, and initiated it. Mm-hmm.
There are a series of four recommendations. Mr. Thomas, do you want to?
I'll give a little background. This was free technical assistance we received from Smart Growth America, a very well-respected nonprofit organization advising on building healthier and economically vibrant communities. That are consistent with where more and more people want to live and work and recreate these days. We wrote a grant application. Leah Christian, who sadly was injured in a car accident this morning and is unable to be here as a result of that, and I think we all wish her the best in her recovery, wrote the grant, and it was successful. We were among the top 10% of rated grant proposals and received the workshop in September. We did a study of parking occupancy in different parts of our downtown area and adjacent neighborhoods, and part of the workshop was presenting the results and an analysis of that study, and another part was visioning what we, how we want to handle parking and transportation as Columbia grows, as we know it's going to, and the downtown area densifies in particular. So some of the specific outcomes were that there is enormous availability in our 10-hour spaces, which are set a little further to the edge of downtown. Also, that in East Campus and Benton Stevens, there is overoccupancy with more cars parked on the blocks than they can really accommodate. And there are discussions with the neighborhood regarding permit programs that could address that. I think the overall, and Mike, jump in if you want to add to this, I think the overall message of the consultants at the end of the workshop was that there are a lot of things we can do in Columbia to reduce parking demand before we need to increase parking supply. And that was where their recommendations fell. They were four recommendations to set up a parking commission, to conduct a mode share analysis and set mode share goals for the whole city, to expand our existing transportation demand management programs, which are kind of education, outreach, communications programs to encourage and reinforce behaviors of not using single occupancy vehicles, and to develop an access and circulation plan. I think we should move forward in some way on each of these. I think the most important one is to set up maybe not a permanent parking commission, but I would suggest that we set up a task force with a specific mission to oversee the implementation of all of these recommendations, maybe meet for a year at the end of which to make a recommendation as to whether the task force should become a permanent commission.
That'd be a great chance for to me to add in. If we did a parking task force, that would also give us some time for to review and update the report in regards to boards and commissions. It's my general feeling that we don't want to expand the footprint of boards and commissions, that if we're going to add new boards and commissions, we should look at the existing boards and commissions that we have, and we should, and if there's any that can be consolidated or eliminated so that we don't continue to add staff time on boards and commissions. So that's for you know, my agreement to that gives us a chance to take I think since we had a pretty robust report, just kind of update on the ones that, because I know like some of the building and trades commissions has historically have a lot of openings. There was a recommendation to consolidate those. There was a little bit of pushback from those commissions, but they said they were going to do more about recruitment and bringing people in. So I want to see, I haven't seen that. So I think updating that report and giving us an opportunity to weigh that. The task force gives us that time to weigh our overall boards and commission structure.
Before
we make a final decision if we want to add another commission.
I guess at the end of my term, I'm becoming a big government liberal. I realized that was going to happen. No, but I think, first of all, the point Mr. Trapp makes about boards and commissions, we have some that don't meet very often, don't have quorums, and don't have a full slate of members. And I think that we should, our review should be go something like this. You know, if you are not making quorum, we have to question whether you need to exist. If we can't appoint people to your commission, then perhaps you're not needed. And just some non-judgmental way of looking at that. Now, as far as parking goes, I tell you, I think we could use a commission. I'll tell you why. I appointed that task force, mm-hmm. and it was only a couple of years ago. And the reason I think we need a permanent body is that parking is very dynamic right now with the technology out there. I mean, I think we know that 20 years from now, if you're going to go to tellers or wherever, that you're going to look at your smartphone to see where the parking spots are, then you're not going to drive around town to find it, and that you're going to use your device to pay for it, and it'll tell you when you got 5 minutes to go, and you can stay there as long as you want. That's where we're headed. So what I'm saying is that decisions we make today are probably not relevant for 3 years or 5 years from now. And I think we've seen that. You know, we've tried some pilot studies, and, you know, the long term is just kind of not working out like we thought it would. So I just think that there's enough going on in parking, and the demands parking downtown are going to continue to evolve and change, that I think a standing commission would be very desirable. And I point out, I thought this some of the information here was really very interesting, I thought, mm-hmm. the audit, mm-hmm. because we have enough capacity for on-street Plenty. Parking,
yeah,
but not on Friday and Saturday night when we don't charge.
Right.
The utilization of the parking garages is
70% at max at the peak.
Well,
time.
And I think anytime I recommend a lot of the time. For any council member who's feeling particularly good about how the city's running to drive through the 5th and Walnut parking garage at 10 o'clock in the morning. And you'll find two-thirds empty. But again,
I'm surprised we haven't actually seen each other in there doing that yet all these years.
Yeah. Well, anyway, not to editorialize, but I just think we have enough issues that currently exist and are going to be ongoing issues over the next several years, particularly since downtown is changing year after year. I think the hard thing about either a task force or a commission is how you who you choose to be on it.
But before we get to that, Bob, I want to just be clear. I think that the sort of technology opportunities that you talk about are important, but I want to be sure we don't lose track of what was sort of the main focus of this workshop, which was about traffic management and parking.
Well, I want to talk about that.
And whether we, you know, need... how we can address the demand for parking.
All right, let's talk about
which
the
brings
commission.
In transit and it brings in you know, pedestrian connectivity.
Right. But as far as the parking commission, let me get back to that. How you populate that is going to be a challenge because you have local interests that are very different. You have Benton Stevens. Students are smart. They're going to park in the closest place to campus that they don't have to pay. You know, they are. I did it in the 60s. You know, that's just the way it's always going to be. And unfortunately, we do have a commuter culture with the university. And so on that basis, you have neighborhoods, your neighborhood, Betsy, and Benton Stevens, that, you know, have too many cars. And we've said to East Campus, give us a solution. And you have such different interests between the homeowners and the landlords that they've been unable to do so. It's almost like watching the musical Oklahoma and listening to the ranchers and the farmers debate. It's just they've just been unable to solve that problem. So that's a very specific issue for that neighborhood. Benton Stevens has a very specific issue. Downtown has a very specific issue. The university, the students would love to park free downtown. As a brief anecdote, I had a meeting with an MSA president about three terms ago, and I said, what's your number one priority? And he told me, downtown parking. And I just wanted to say, you know, it's really not for students. I didn't, but it's for commerce. But again, I think that I would recommend that we ask these groups to come up with recommendations for how they would populate a commission.
Yeah, and it clearly has to represent all of the relevant stakeholders.
I think you got to have MSA. I think you got to have university administration, but I think you got to have East Campus, Benton Stevens. Probably you got to have probably Fourth Ward involved too. And Benton Stevens is third, First Ward. So I'm just saying somebody should come up with. And again, the CID needs to have a strong influence there because their needs are very different.
And I do think whether it's task force or a permanent commission, the first focus has to be to study these recommendations and follow up on them. And with that in mind, I would suggest, tell me what you think of this, that we were to call it a parking and traffic management commission.
That would be fine. That would be fine. But again, can we ask these different diverse groups to come back with their recommendation on how it should be constituted?
Sure. Staff could do that process and then come with a proposal for how it would be populated to cover all the stakeholders.
Just a couple of comments here. I think it's important to keep the philosophy in mind. I think you're right, Ian. I mean, in terms of keeping the focus on the demand side rather than on the supply side, I think it's important. I don't quite share the same philosophy as Mr. Trapp when it comes to boards and commissions, not to suggest that we want any new ones that don't serve any purpose, and not to suggest that we shouldn't get rid of those that are not functioning very well, or at least pair them back so that they can function better. But if we have a really good reason to have a board or commission or a permanent commission, just like the suggestion earlier from the Downtown Leadership Council, they have a Blue Ribbon Commission on Infrastructure. Instead, we took the task force route, and I think it's going to be valuable. But I see no reason why, if there's a good reason for it, we shouldn't have it. And this traffic issue, management issue, could be one of those reasons. In the meantime, however, Benton Stevens was raised a number of times, so was East Campus, because there are these parking issues because of overflow parking, because of the students and so on. It was very difficult and impossible, apparently, for East Campus to come up with a plan. And there was in the mix, in the queue, in fact, first of all, in the Arts District, that was the first parking permit program. Next up, if you will, with Barbara on the City Council was East Campus. That did not pan out. I've been assured by the city manager that very soon there will be at least the description of how we're going to approach that in Benton Stevens to get a parking permitting program going there. And on top of all of this, the staff is, as I read the comments here, a little bit lukewarm on some of these ideas about establishing permanent boards and commissions until we take a look or at least evaluate some of what we have in place already in terms of not only the recommendations from this group, but also some of the recommendations that are forthcoming from some of the plans we have in existence. So I'm in no super hurry. I think we need to address this for sure. And just a comment with respect to the mayor's look to the future. I appreciate that look to the future, and that absolutely is probably true. Absolutely is probably. That's not really, both of those can't happen, right? But at any rate, it's likely, in terms of probability, that we are going to have a lot more people with a lot more cell phones doing electronic things when it comes to parking. On the other hand, we can't forget those folks that still have quarters, right? And everything else. And it's one of the reasons there was an issue just recently that we tried this, I guess we're trying a pilot project where there is absolutely no chance of anybody putting any coins in the meter. You have to have a cell phone in order to park there. That may be problematic. I'm not sure, but we need to look at that at any rate. So you know, for a lot of those reasons, I think that we certainly should take some of these considerations seriously. We ought to have that overall focus, but I think we should proceed a little bit more cautiously than just to endorse the recommendations.
Right. Well, what if we create a 12-month task force? Parking and Traffic Management Task Force to work through the other proposals, the other recommendations from the workshop, and then create a proposal if they decide to for a commission.
Well, any task force can obviously recommend a commission to follow up their work.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I don't think it matters in the first 12 months. I mean, the job is the same. And I do suspect they will see the value in a long-term commission. I mean, here we are 2 years after the last one, and we're talking about it again. But is a way to, let me ask you this. Would you agree that a way to do this is to ask the stakeholders I've mentioned to recommend how they would constitute
a task
force?
And one stakeholder we haven't mentioned in this discussion is the downtown CID.
Well,
has asked for a commission multiple times in the last year or two. Yeah, I think that's fine. I think that the next step should be that the staff interview different stakeholders and then come up with a proposal for the makeup.
I will tell you that the CID's initial proposal was for a seven-member commission where they had four seats. So I think we've got a lot of work to do here to constitute
this. We've got to
balance
a lot of interests here.
So, you know, let's get a consensus from these different groups about do they want to be involved. I suspect each neighborhood that we've mentioned will want to be involved because they are primarily impacted.
And one way they could poll on this is to email all of the people that participated in the workshop, which I think represented most of those groups. That needn't be the only way.
And you can use the last task force as a template
and the last
also.
Skip Walther's task force as well.
Come up with a recommendation. If you wanted to call the task force, I do think the task force will probably recommend a commission, but that's just...
But it seems more appropriate. We've had a one-day event. We've got some very specific things that have been recommended by the experts. Let's call it a task force, but ask them to work on those and then recommend permanency or not.
So we're asking for the city to come back with a report on the constitution of a
parking and traffic management task force.
Okay.
Do we have to vote on it?
Let me make the motion and you second it.
Okay.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Okay. Very good. The 5-16 is the pedestrian safety interim report.
There. Do we want to address? Oh, and then we're going to leave the other recommendations to the task force.
You know what? May I just make no, let's just leave it at that. And
I'll come back. I'm sure though.
This will be the template for their work. This will be the basis of their work.
Well, let me just, without making any formal proposals, I just want to kind of share a few things that Mike and I actually discussed by email today. I do think that developing a system for measuring mode share consistently is an important part of this. They said we should do that and we should Then set goals going into the future as we anticipate how traffic's going or how mobility, transportation demand is going to grow. Set goals for mode share between transit and cars and biking and walking. One way we could possibly do that, we are about to start work with Olson Associates, the transit consultant, and that would be very appropriate. So I don't know, Dave, if you could think about negotiating with them in addition to that contract.
Yeah, I think once we get underway, that's something we can enter into a discussion about.
Great. The Transportation Demand Management Program, Get About Columbia, does a lot of encouragement and education around using alternative modes, but I don't think we work with the university, with the University Students Association, or with large employers. So I'd love the task force to look at other cities that do those kind of programs and see if Get About Columbia can expand and really start developing some materials that other employers and organizations can use with their constituents to encourage them to use alternative modes. The access and circulation plan, I think, is something that we needn't implement immediately. But there is an important issue in there, which it would be useful to get data about, which is as people move and live in downtown Columbia, how many of them are bringing cars currently? How many of them would not bring cars if there were a better public transport system and so on? So I would say that would be something that the task force should explore as well.
I hate to bring this up, but in a way, one of my biggest disappointments over the 6 years I've been in office has been the failure to engage the university students and administration with transit. Tried. In a way, I think the task force and our commission with representation would be a way to basically invite them in. I think it could be very useful.
And students are very concerned about the parking problem as well. I mean, they're the villains when they leave their cars in East Campus. At the same time, it's a huge hassle for them as well. And I can tell you that the survey, the official survey that Jackie Jones commissioned many years ago showed that the majority of students want a better bus service and are willing to pay more for it.
The amount they were willing to pay was virtually insignificant, mm-hmm. though.
No, that's not true, Bob.
Yeah.
That's not true.
They were willing to pay $25 a semester.
It was a majority of students that were willing to pay more. There was an incremental opportunity there.
Well, you're not looking...
Now it's 3 or 4 years later, and they are even more.
The market's $80 a semester a student, free fare. That's what all the systems have, and they were not willing to pay that. But that's the job of the next administration. That's the job of the next council. That's the job of this task force, is to try to engage them, because they're paying a lot more than that.
So I think an MSA representative on this parking and traffic management task force is essential.
Okay. a lot of work to do there. Well, can we move on then?
Yes.
The pedestrian safety interim report. This was Dr. Ruff and Dr. Thomas were both in on this, so... Do you have any comments you want to lead off, or who wants to lead off on this? It's an informational report.
I'll just underscore, refer back to Annette Triplett's presentation this morning, or earlier this evening, and she also made a presentation to the task force going into a lot more detail about Vision Zero. Nationally, we have 30,000 traffic deaths a year and 4 million serious injuries. And this Vision Zero philosophy is a strategy that says that these deaths are not necessary, that safety should be the number one factor in designing our transportation systems, and that we can do that without unduly slowing down mobility. It's that there are various steps that can be taken in the education, enforcement, and engineering realm. The task force was impressed by this. They voted to frame all the recommendations within the framework of Vision Zero. When they come back with the full, or when we come back with our full report, when we wrap up our work in March, I suspect there will be a recommendation to adopt a Vision Zero policy and strategy here at the City of Columbia, as an increasing number of other cities are doing. Anything you want to add to that, Clyde?
No, thank you. The infrastructure report is something that's produced annually, and it's really kind of a brief report and is an overview of something that's very complicated. But I think it's really well done, and I think for people who have had no exposure to everything the city does, I think it's a great starting point. And I think for future council members, people on boards and commissions, I think it's an essential learning tool. So it's really a primer on at a 50,000-foot level about.
I think you're right. I mean, this kind of reminds me as well as the Budget 101 kind of graphic.
Yeah,
I mean, these things is complicated. That's right. And I think and it is a view from way up top. I mean, at some point or another, you want to get into the how much does it cost and how are we going to pay for it. That's what the infrastructure task force, that's at least part of their charge, is going to come up with. But this is a tremendous interface between the public and the community, and an attempt to write small for a very complicated issue.
Yeah, right.
I think it's well done.
I appreciate
done.
It. I think it's well done. Report 716 is a report on the number of volunteer hours to the City of Columbia. And it's one of the great things about this city, isn't it, about how much volunteerism there is? 33,800 hours just with the City of Columbia. And that doesn't even talk about people who volunteer in coaching soccer, brownie troops, whatever. So it's an amazing city, and this just is another reason we all love it.
We do the volunteer report every year. It would be helpful to kind of see where our numbers go. I mean, just to have some historical context for the next iteration of the report.
5 or maybe a 10-year summary. I think we've been doing it close to 10 years. We
probably get that'd be great.
Get at least 5-year data.
Yeah, that'd be super, just to be able to see how it moves through time. I know it went down last
and
year.
And the Cleanup Columbia weekend in April is just an amazing part of this. And if you could track how many volunteers are involved in that, because that's just an amazing event. People are willing to give up one of the best early April Saturdays to go out there and clean up streams and roads and stuff like that.
Mayor, we tallied 2,500 hours approximately on Cleanup Columbia.
Report 8 is transfer funds. Other questions?
Yeah, I had one question. There was an item transferring $50,000, and it referenced widening Forum Boulevard to 5 lanes. I'm just interested to know which project that refers to and why the money's being transferred.
I don't know without doing a little bit more research on that particular project, unless Dave or John are around and can comment on it. I really don't know without doing some more research.
Okay, well, could you, if that can't be answered right mm-hmm. now, if you could just
sure.
give me the explanation of that transfer and
absolutely.
What that project is. Thanks.
I'll yield 3 minutes to anyone from the public who wants to talk about anything. Come up to the dais, and that way it can be recorded, and name and address.
My name is Tom Luther. I live at 104 Dene Drive here in Columbia. My question was on releasing monies and finances to Room at the Inn. Does anybody know how much money we are giving them?
Yeah, it's in the report. Let's see.
3,500. Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? Seeing none? I thought I'd get you to move.
Eugene Elkin, 3406 Range Line. Glad to hear the gentleman asking, inquiring about Room at the Inn, because I often do speak on the subject of homelessness. Regretfully, I have to tell that earlier this year, I asked about a gentleman that had come up deceased on April 1st, when the city manager had to actually discover 2 to 3 months later what did happen to the individual, the full story. No one claimed the body, and just different matters to do with this. Within the last 5 days, we've now lost a black lady that had probably been going to our church for 6 or 7 years as a member and somehow fell into homelessness. I helped the lady with some medication, and she was to get an apartment, and her Social Security was stolen. After struggling in the homeless shelter for women, she began to have to walk the streets. I was never able to quite catch up with the story, but this is what I was told. You must leave every day at a specific hour and go out in the cold. This lady, along with another member of our church, has had major cancer. I believe they both probably had 2 to 3 kinds of cancer. I gave each one a piece of paper of knowledge that I have on that subject. They both said they were going on, if you call it remission or what would you call it, they were free of cancer. The reason I'm bringing all this up is in the end, she got a place to live 3 months before, 3 weeks before death. She passed in her bed after struggling for days and days and days. And I felt really bad knowing I stepped up, and you know I work with these people. I got her some medicine and only hoped that her life would go on. Never dreamed that she'd die at the age of 57, 58 years of age. Could we have a report in the future on the actual income off of natural gas station or the airport? In these last 5 or 6 years when things have been speeded up, let's stay away from profit and loss. Let's just say what has been generated from all y'all's work. It's really important. A 30-year couple has returned to Columbia. They couldn't believe the changes in this city they call their town. I don't know if that was good or bad. I say thank you to all the volunteers. The number 33,800 is a very impressive number. For that was part of my mission when I brought Habitat here in 88. We need to know that that's a mark of Columbia, and it means a very important thing. When you have nothing else to do, can you please volunteer any and everywhere? Thank you.
All in the new year. Actually, I want to talk about community policing, and what I want to say is
John, you do have to give your name and address.
It's John Clark, 403 North Vine Street. I want to stand here in support of what Mike Trapp said at the last Community Violence Task Force meeting, and I believe what he said. I believe the community has a right to decide what kind of policing it wants. He said that was what he got out of going to Gainesville. Well, I'm going to make a proposal, and a lot of people, that we want community policing. And by that, I mean we want the community to be able to be involved on an equal basis, I mean really equal basis with the police department, in setting the mission, vision, strategies, goals, policies, methods of oversight, ultimately budget allocations, and so forth. That's what community policing is. It's a philosophy and approach that emphasizes shared decision-making authority over these core structures, goals, so forth, but down into the policy structure, whether we're going to emphasize reducing use of force, all this kind of stuff. The presentation that you heard from the police department tonight is anything but shared. In fact, it basically was their reaction to something and said, we're doing it, we're making progress and so forth. But there is not meaningful input into that. Their notion of community policing has been stuck on the dime of one-third, we only do that, we have 50 officers. And that is a recipe for them to keep control over what is policing, what is policy, and so forth, as though they know what is best for all of us. I repeat, our community has the right to decide what kind of policing it wants. You need to reject that approach And, of course, I think that you should, one, adopt a philosophy and approach of community policing, basically as I've outlined, and to implement and make sure there is this community input. Because you all are elected, but you aren't meaningfully the community that's going to go through a 15-month or two-year process. But basically to set up a community-based strategic planning process. This is how you will get to that. We can get the massive benefits of community policing in terms of trust, in terms of long-term public support for the department, better recruiting, better retention, better morale, long before we have the budget for 30, 40, 50 more officers. Don't buy the argument that community policing is only about on-the-ground people. We have the money and the budget to get started on this now. Thank you.
Anyone else? Council, want to start down?
Just congratulations on how many volunteer hours we have.
Great.
And it's impressive. I have nothing else.
I endorse everything John just said about community policing, that we have to engage the whole community in a strategic planning process. And I do think that the fact that the police department responded to the 21st century policing report by the president's task force is a very good sign. I would have appreciated knowing that that was in process. Did any other council members know that that report was being prepared until it appeared on the agenda? You did?
No, you're right. I mean, yeah. I saw the pre-council agenda. I didn't know anything else.
Yeah, so I filled a lot of questions. What's happening with community policing? Is it anything being done? And I did not know that that project was in progress. So I would ask that staff kind of keep us informed of things that are in the works like that so that, you know, we can answer more accurately. So my other point, question really, there has been a change in the federal government's treatment of the Missouri driver's license. I don't know if you know how that whether that impacts people getting through Transportation Security Administration at the airport.
Not yet, but it could.
That's
yet to be determined.
I think
I read the feds are supposed to give states at least 180 days notice before it starts impacting airports, so you can get passports and things
passports.
But hopefully the state legislature will fix this so we can, you know, go to prisons or whatever other federal facilities we need to.
All right, thanks.
I just have one issue that I really wanted to talk about. I wanted to request a report from the city manager's office. It has to do with homelessness. I distributed through the city clerk several resources, and some of what I have benefited from attending some of the national meetings. This really all started at one of the national meetings that was in Kansas City. It was the Partners for Smart Growth meeting. And the mayor of Salt Lake City was talking about this along with a few other groups in conjunction. Since that time, Salt Lake City has achieved a remarkable level of homelessness. And most of the cities that get involved in this start out from a veteran's point of view, and it kind of morphs into a homeless relief just in general. Some of the success stories are pretty remarkable. We have achieved in our community some measure of success with homeless veterans. The Columbia Housing Authority is building a building as we speak in the third ward adjacent to I-70 and so on. And there have been some cooperative efforts with the VA and so on. And the city manager here is deputy city manager. I anticipated some of the questions that I might have when I distributed this council and came up with about a 1.5-page homeless data handout, if you will, that kind of describes several years back and this year with respect to homeless data in the Columbia Boone County area, both unsheltered, sheltered, and total. And for 2015 in the winter, we were talking about 49 sheltered, 194 unsheltered, and 354 total. homeless folks. Now, other places besides Salt Lake City, as I suggested to the council of Phoenix, New Orleans, and most recently Philadelphia, they've all attained pretty remarkable results. And the video that I made available to everybody, I would urge everybody to take a look at it and watch it maybe a couple times. It was from Nashville. I have since posted it on my Facebook website. If anybody wants to see it before we can distribute it through the staff, and my website, by the way, is www.facebook.com, carl.scala. You'll see it. It will be called Sanctuary. And in fact, it is about a five-minute clip or something like that that talks about tiny homes and a public-private partnership in conjunction with an Elia Mosneri organization that provided some startup homes that are lockable and so on for some of the homeless as a relatively inexpensive solution. There's a whole list of data resources. I would urge the council to take a look at this, and I would request that report from the city manager and to try and make some of this information available to the public, because I suspect that there's a tremendous thirst to help some of our less fortunate citizens in our community. Thank you.
Just add on to a couple of the issues that have come up tonight. First of all, we've had a series of meetings in regards to discussion on implementation of the Mayor's Task Force on Community Violence recommendations. We had scheduled our fourth meeting to focus on reentry and possibly an overall long-term reimplementation strategy for January 12th. So from what I understand, our room is not available, and so we've come back to the drawing board for January dates. So I just learned that today. I forwarded out of those dates that were offered the dates that I'm available to Ms. Nauser. So hopefully people should keep a lookout for when our next public meeting comes up in regards to January. We'll send a press release and there'll be some, I'm sure, some media attention to it, but it's going to be hard to get the word out with the change of date. So hopefully it'll at least be after our next meeting so we can announce it at City Council. Just wanted to make some brief comment about the report. I very much appreciate the police department's attempt to digest the presidential task force recommendation. Each chapter being written by a different lieutenant, if you read the report, the voices were very, very different. And I very much appreciate the chief's ability to allow divergent voices in regards to administration. It speaks to me about an ability to have a healthy dialogue about policing. There's a lot of inherently controversial items that go along with that, and we've made a lot of progress. There's a lot of work left to be done, you know, just kind of looking from where we were beginning at and where does the community expect us to be at. You know, there's this huge disconnect there, and I think that we continue to make some good efforts. There has been some efforts to involve the community, not to the extent that Mr. Clark so eloquently described the And I do love the idea of increasing that public participation in it. You know, I think we've dipped our toe in the waters in regards to involving the community in the interviewing of the community outreach officers for that unit. I think that was a great step. I also heard some willingness within that report to involve community members in regards to training, which gets into one of the references in the Mayor's Task Force on Community Violence. Overall, it just showed a good cognizance of the recommendations that body made, the process of working towards accreditation. You know, there's just a lot of policies and procedures that need to be worked out and implemented, and you have to have implemented it for a year or so before you can really go for accreditation. So I think there's a lot of good things happening just by the nature of how much of it and just how throughout the entire, it's not just a top-down directive-based approach, but there are a lot of initiatives that kind of percolate through the department that are moving in these directions, and I think that gets into some communication issues. I know they're
police are looking at retooling the way that they do communications, and I think that that's going to improve both doing things in a better way and then also telling the story about how we're improving things. Do appreciate Mr. Scala bringing up the issue of homelessness, certainly Mr. Elkins bringing it up. You know, routinely, I think it's an important issue. Just I am involved with those efforts, and we have a, you know, the cities that have ended chronic homelessness and veterans homelessness has really been through the leadership of the Veterans Administration. And our own Truman Hospital VA is leading a similar community-wide effort. We had a meeting this morning, Functional Zero Task Force. Functional Zero is that idea of when you end homelessness, what does it mean? Does it mean every? It means that there's a shelter bed for anybody who wants one and that nobody stays in a shelter more than 90 days and they're moved towards. Another way you can look at it is how many folks need housing and how many housing opportunities are we creating, and as long as that number of opportunities exceeds, then that's what we call zero. There's always going to be a need for places like Welcome Home and shelter services. We also may see some folks on the street because of choices that people make, but we can do better. But the community is rallied, and we're creating memorandums of understanding and agreements, which are complicated because of confidentiality laws that bind us all. But we want to do a by name list to be able to identify who are our chronic homeless folks, who are our veterans who are homeless, and rank them based upon vulnerability and need, and then being able to move them quickly into shelter or permanent housing by using the resources that already exist within the community. Steve Hollis is very much representing the city in regards to those efforts and is a strong leader and has really pushed those agencies like my own that have state funding to address issues around housing and homelessness to corral all of us independent service providers into working together and to doing a community-wide coordinated outreach program rather than each of us kind of taking our own scattershot efforts to address the problem, which is all how the proposal system that drives a lot of social services funding works. We all say, here's my best shot to end this problem that's way too big for me to deal with, and every other agency does the same thing. And so the cities, through Steve Hollis's leadership, shows just a lot of bringing those resources together and making sure that we're talking to each other, that we're coordinating our efforts. And so those efforts are we've always had a good level of cooperation, and that's because of the city's leadership through the Basic Needs Coalition, but it's really elevated to a whole nother level. There are some more shelter services that are coming online. They're going to have people living at Patriot Place in March. You know, they're already looking at, 25 folks, getting them through the approval processes, is getting their vouchers in place, and then with move-in dates, leases starting March 1, so that's going to happen very soon, and the Welcome Home Shelter is doing well in their capital campaign and should be coming along as well. Room at the Inn is in need of volunteers. They have put out an appeal to the social service agency, so if, as we mentioned, Columbia is a great town for volunteers, so if anyone has any free nights and evenings to devote to the Room at the Inn. We've got folks from all of the agencies that do outreach to homeless for homeless folks out there doing screening people so that we can look for permanent housing placements for those. So there's a lot of things that are going on, and shelter beds, and on as important as they are, you know, the fundamental driver of family homelessness is a lack of affordable housing. So we've also started some of those long-range things to really deal with the root causes of the issues, and so that's what's going on.
Well, 2016 is going to be a great year to be here and to occupy these positions. I can see that there are many initiatives coming down the line that will have lasting impact in terms of improving the quality of life and moving us closer towards social equity. I was also very pleased to hear the police department's report today regarding the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. My only disappointment was that the presentation seemed to be so rushed. I had lots of questions about the implementation of some of these initiatives, but I think that as we go forward in terms of applying our vision to the three strategic areas that have been identified in our city, which will all benefit from community policing initiatives, and will engage the community and the public in the same level of dialogue that Mr. Clark has recommended, will certainly be an opportunity to have many of those questions answered and hopefully move us closer towards our vision for what this city should become. So it's a great time to be here. Thanks.
Meeting's adjourned.